This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Militiamen loyal to the Unity government captured two districts inside Sirte amid heavy fighting and reports of casualties on both sides.
That's Edward Yerenian reporting from Cairo. Details next.
Also, a U.S. general says Islamic State militants are very likely to shift their focus to ungoverned regions of Africa. And a senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company has confirmed that the government has reached a ceasefire with a militant group that's targeted the country's vital oil infrastructure.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, forces loyal to Libya's new national unity government in Tripoli, the capital, have reported making gains inside the Islamic State-held coastal city of Sirte. More than 35 militia died in today's fighting there. Also, a rival government in Tobruk to the east says it has pushed back al-Qaeda militants in Benghazi. And about 30 civilians died in Tripoli when an ammunition dump exploded. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Militiamen loyal to the Unity government captured two districts inside Sirte amid heavy fighting and reports of casualties on both sides. Ahmed Hadia, a spokesman for pro-government military forces in Sirte, told Libyan TV that battles took place in several areas.
قوات البنيان المرصوص حققت تقدما على جميع المحاور في الزعفران والغربيات.
He says pro-government militiamen had pushed IS fighters out of the Zafran and Garbiat districts and quartered them in small pockets of the 700 district and the Ouagadougou conference center. Islamic State fighters were reported to be fighting fiercely despite recent losses, using car bombs, suicide attackers, and other booby-trapped objects. A government military commander in Sirte told journalists that IS fighters had booby-trapped vehicles and shops to stop the government advance into the city. The Libya Herald newspaper reported that 170 pro-government militiamen have been killed and over 700 injured since the start of the military operation dubbed Bunyan al-Marsous to retake Sirte. The paper added that many of the casualties in the fighting were taken to Misrata Central Hospital, where doctors refused to allow journalists to take photos. It indicated that many of the wounded had suffered horrific injuries and that conditions at the hospital were poor because of shortages of drugs, antibiotics, and even nurses. Arab media also reported heavy fighting inside Libya's second largest city of Benghazi, as forces loyal to the government in Tobruk fought to expel Islamic militants loyal to al-Qaeda. Heavy clashes against militants took place in the nearby port of Ajdabiya several days ago. A spokesman for Libyan military units in the east of the country, loyal to Army Commander Khalifa Haftar, told journalists that his forces were advancing against the militants near the district of Sabri and Souk al-Hout near Benghazi. The Libyan army has made similar claims of gains against militants in Benghazi in the past. Forces loyal to General Haftar have also carried out airstrikes against Islamic militant positions near Ajdabiya and the eastern militant stronghold of Darna in recent days. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A U.S. general testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee yesterday that Islamic State militants are very likely to shift their focus to ungoverned regions of Africa. Lieutenant General Thomas Waldhauser told committee members yesterday that the Islamic State's current defense of the city of Sirte in Libya is a backup position to territories under their control in the Middle East. Waldhauser also talked about another militant force in northwest Nigeria. He says about half of the Boko Haram forces recently formed a separate group that is even more aligned with Islamic State beliefs. The general said he is concerned this new splinter group could attack Western targets.
The Eritrean ambassador to the United Nations has told the UN Human Rights Council that he believes neighboring Ethiopia is preparing to attack their border. Girma Asmaram Tesfaye says that there is clear evidence that Ethiopia has adopted a hostile policy. Asmaram has told VOA his charge is based on statements made in the Ethiopian parliament. He says Ethiopia wants regime change in Eritrea's capital, Asmara. Ethiopian officials dismissed the charge. Eritrean and Ethiopian troops recently clashed along their borders at the Tesorona Central Front, an area located south of Asmara. Eritrea's foreign ministry also has accused the United States of playing a role of instigating a recent clash between the two countries. State Department spokesman John Kirby has dismissed the accusation and urged the two countries to work toward a stable and peaceful region.
A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company has confirmed that the government had reached a ceasefire with a militant group that targeted the country's vital oil infrastructure. The Niger Delta Avengers militants, however, deny reaching any such truce with the government. Christine reports from Lagos.
A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company, who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity, confirmed the ceasefire deal, but offered no further details. The Niger Delta Avengers militant group said on Twitter no ceasefire had been agreed to. Months of attacks by the Avengers on petroleum infrastructure in the Delta have dropped Nigeria's oil production by as much as half from its usual level of around 2 million barrels per day. Oil is Nigeria's top export. Economists have cited the drop in production as one reason the country's economy, which is Africa's largest, will soon enter a recession. Earlier this month, the government announced it was suspending military operations in the Delta to pave the way for talks. The vice president for Africa operations at intelligence firm Stratfor, Mark Schroeder, says the ceasefire may be a delaying tactic by Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
It could be to buy time while President Buhari has to essentially negotiate or calculate among his other political constituencies, you know, whether he can afford to increase revenue sharing with the Niger Delta region.
The Southern Delta region is home to almost all of Nigeria's oil production, but remains deeply impoverished. Militancy is nothing new there. A similar insurgency raged until 2009, when the government started paying off fighters and giving them job training in exchange for their halting attacks. The Avengers, a mysterious group that communicates primarily through a Twitter account, could not be reached for comment. In a statement last week, the Avengers demanded the federal government commit to independently mediated talks. The confusion over the truce's existence may be a sign of factionalism within the Avengers, Schroeder said, or it may just be impatience with the Buhari administration. Much of what the group is demanding are resolutions to long-standing grievances in the Delta.
What they want to see above all is some reasonable offer of engagement by the Buhari government.
The Avengers' most recent attack was June 16th. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
A Nigerian philanthropist is publishing a book based on 50 years of research on Nigeria's outcast system titled Love and Stigma, The Outcast System. The author, Sir Adolphus Ekejuma, is a retired geologist and community activist. He is working to abolish the outcast system in Nigeria so that people who have been stigmatized and discriminated against can achieve freedom and justice. He spoke with me about his research, the deep-rooted causes of class discrimination, and his work with Nigeria's underprivileged communities.
The problem is there is class discrimination whereby some people are classed as outcasts and some as freeborn. And this is happening in Nigeria among the Igbo tribes, in India, and in some other countries in Africa and Asia. This leads to discrimination and stigmatization. People from one group are not allowed to interact freely with the other. There is no intermarriage. And because of that, these people are denied a lot of their fundamental human rights.
What is the driving force that allows this to continue in this day?
The main thing is associated with mindset. It is not affecting everybody. And those affected are in a minority. And that's why the majority of the people tend to overload it over the others. People claim that it was instituted by our forefathers. And that's why they will not be the ones to stop it. But I have reasons to show them that that is not a good argument. Because there are many other institutions of practices that we have made by our forefathers that we have stopped, like the killing of twins, like the use of human hair to bury important people, like moving about naked or half-naked, like the non-education of the girl child, female genital mutilation, idol worship, punitive widowhood practices. But I tell them, these things have to stop. We stop these ones because it affected everybody, while the other one, the outcast system, is not affecting everybody, and for that, people tend to look at it without minding how it affects the others. And that's why I call on my fellow learned people, educated people in the non-outcast system, to join forces to stop this outcast system.
Now, I understand there's an outcast system elimination project going on. Can you tell me about the project and how that is working to help eliminate some of these prejudices?
What we are doing is to educate people, because we don't want to do it by force, to let people understand why this is wrong and why we should stop it. We have looked at where people are the same, from science, from religion, from sociology. We have put facts and figures that prove that all people are the same, and therefore there should not be any more further discrimination between people.
Is this actively going on now, for instance, in some African countries where people are on the ground out educating people?
Yes, this is actually what I have initiated. Some efforts in the past to stop it did not quite work. And that's why I have written this book, Love and Stigma, the Outcast System, where I've listed out the various reasons why we should stop the outcast system. I've tried to teach, make presentations in churches and in communities before coming out here. And the essence of coming out here is to enlighten the international community to assist in fighting against our brothers and sisters called the outcasts.
Do you have an example of a success story that you can share regarding someone or some group of people that have changed their traditional beliefs or prejudices?
Yes. In some parts of Igbo land, really, especially in the Anambra state, they have been able to overcome the outcast system and abolish it. In some other areas, because of religion, people have also abandoned the outcast system as a sub-part of their Christian belief. But in some other areas, it still keeps staying, and we want to make it a general practice that everywhere it occurs, it should be abandoned, because it's a human rights issue.
Sir Adolphus Ekejuba is a retired geologist and community activist. He is author of the book Love and Stigma, The Outcast System. He spoke with me from Baltimore, Maryland. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Forces loyal to Libya's new national unity government in Tripoli have reportedly made gains inside the Islamic State-held coastal city of Sirte. A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company has confirmed that the government had reached a ceasefire with a militant group that's targeted the country's vital oil infrastructure. And the Eritrean ambassador to the United Nations has told the UN Human Rights Council that he believes neighboring Ethiopia is preparing to attack their border. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
As early as tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to hand down a landmark opinion in the case of the United States versus Texas. The ruling will be one of intense interest to immigration advocates. It focuses on Obama's 2014 deferred deportation for undocumented parents of Americans and lawful permanent residents, and the expansion of the 2012 deferred action for childhood arrivals. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with attorney Mauricio Norona of African Services Committee, a nonprofit advocacy in New York's Harlem neighborhood, about the case.
The Obama administration has proposed to allow people who are parents of children who are United States citizens or permanent residents to stay in the country in lawful status. So it doesn't necessarily give them a permanent residency, but they wouldn't be deported. And they would have access to an employment authorization, and in practical terms, to be able to have a social security number, to be able to work, and don't have the power and the strength of the law at their back. The other rule is an expansion of DACA. So DACA is a program that was announced in 2012, and it allowed people who came in while being young to be able to stay in the country, to be able to have an employment authorization. What Obama proposed in 2014 was an expansion of that program so that it would cover people who had gone over the age of 31 who were originally not eligible for DACA.
And the Supreme Court is ruling on whether these are constitutional policies, whether the president has a right to proclaim these things, or is it the constitutionality of the policies per se that is at stake?
So the question that the Supreme Court is handling at this moment is twofold. One of them is whether the states have a standing, so basically whether they have a stake in these decisions. And the 26 states that filed this lawsuit, what they're claiming is that they would have to spend a lot of money in government programs, such as giving out driver's licenses to people who become eligible for DACA. And they're saying that this will harm them. So one of the questions is whether or not the states have even the standing to bring this lawsuit. The other issue, which is the more substantive issue, is whether or not the president is exceeding his executive powers. And the allegation is that in order for you to do such a broad application of deferred action, you would have to go through Congress.
The president says that he does have this authority. Others say he doesn't.
The president says that this is well within his powers to decide where the federal government puts his money. Basically, the reasoning is that the federal government doesn't have enough resources to deport 12 million people, 13 million people, whatever the number is. So they would concentrate on people who are priority, people who have a prior criminal background, people who have a prior deportation order. So those are the people that the government says we'll look into, and that's where we'll spend the money, and we don't want to spend the money, or we don't have enough resources to concentrate on everyone else. The opponents say that, no, that in fact the executive does not have the power to create a law that benefits people in such a wide application. They say that the president has to go through Congress and that there has to be actual immigration reform or a law in order for this to happen.
What does this mean specifically to the African diaspora community?
It means a lot. One of the particularities of the African community is the problems that are sometimes experienced back in their countries, and the ability to have a way of staying in the United States and not fear the return if for some reason. The application of DAPA and the expanded youth program means the ability to stay in the country without the fear of being deported. It means having an employment authorization document, Social Security, the ability to apply for a driver's license. Things that for somebody who was born in the country or for somebody who's always had these papers don't really mean that much. But for somebody who's been undocumented, it's a difference between getting a good job and not getting one. It's a difference between living in fear or living peacefully.
So obviously I know which way I think you want it to go.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we're really hopeful at African Services Committee that the board decides in President Obama's favor and that this becomes active very soon.
That was attorney Mauricio Noronha speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips.
The 11th global meeting of the National Transfer Account Network opened this week in Dakar. Among those attending is Liberian activist Lima Gobwe, who won the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize for work advancing women's rights. VOA reporter Alpha Jalom talked to her.
We can play in achieving demographic dividend. First thing first, if you look at the increase in population, the women are the ones who give birth to children, and I think for us to talk about harnessing demographic dividend, we need to begin to look at where women are in our communities, because you understand that the more educated a woman is, the better her chances for economic empowerment, the better the chances of her children of being educated. And so if we're harnessing this and think that we can leave women behind in this conversation, it's a disservice not just to communities but to ourselves. We need to get women involved in this whole conversation, not only because we're talking about harnessing the dividend, but also we're talking about lowering the increase in the population. And today we heard people talk about reproductive health and rights and family planning. But family planning and lowering our population can only happen if women begin to own their bodies. In most of our communities, the decision for a woman to do family planning is not hers. It's primarily linked to the cultural background, her husband's decision, and we need to change that.
Now, do you believe that demographic dividends can remove barriers to women's economic empowerment?
I think respecting women's rights and allowing them to do what they need to do and providing the space for them to exert themselves can remove the barrier to women's empowerment. But if we insist that women continue to play the minor role of housewife and not providing opportunities for them to excel, we will never get to where we need to get to. So when we talk about harnessing demographic dividend, even as we focus on the youth, we need to also focus on how do we empower women to make this possible.
Now, we also know that in Africa, a large portion of the women population engage in the non-formal sector work. How can demographic dividends help women to grab a large portion of the formal workforce?
Well, we have to begin to invest in education. And as we talk about, again, harnessing demographic dividend for and looking specifically at the youth, we need to look at the girls, the ratio between girls and boys in school. What kind of opportunities are we creating for them? Because today they are girls, tomorrow they will become women. Do we want the situation to remain as it is today, where women continue to fight for a place in the workforce, or women continue to be backwards in the community? It's important for us to really focus on girls. But all of this can only happen if governments are committed to infusing the resources that is needed, the funding that is needed into the programs, into their budgets to make these happen. It cannot happen through policies. Yes, policies are good, but we've seen policies over the years. It cannot happen through conferences. We've gone to enough conferences. It's time for action. It's time for the talk to be followed by the resources and the political will. Thank you.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Lema Gobwe. She was speaking with reporter Alpha Jalo in Dakar, Senegal. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the 18-year-old prison sentence given to former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba by the International Criminal Court for rape and murder in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here